You're at the beginning of a work in progress. The Tekesquite Park Project is 43 acres of undeveloped land between the Wood Streets and Mount Rubidoux. That's today, but by fall of 2012, it will be transformed into new athletic fields, a playground, a trailhead for neighboring Mount Rubidoux, and a place where the land will be preserved in a natural state. And it all began with a recent simple ceremony.
Tekesquite Park is actually a replacement for Evans Park, which was taken almost 40 years ago for expansion of community hospital facilities. People are really excited to see that it is finally happening, but it has been very frustrating for the Wood Streets and Grand neighborhoods, which have never had their own park in the time since Evans Park was closed. So they're relieved, they're pleased, they're excited, and they can't wait for it to actually open up.
The downtown neighborhood really doesn't have an active park. We have Fairmont Park, we have Carlson, we have Mount Rubidoux, but there isn't a park where children can actually come out and participate in active activities such as baseball or softball or basketball.
Our problem is that we've had to go all over the city, and we also take care of the East Side kids, and we bring them down here. But when we would schedule a game at the very last minute, RCC may have to cancel it because they had a tournament or they wanted to practice. And we'd then have to go find another place. And it made parents very upset because they had plans in this way. We feel once the park is built, that we'll grow.
Plans for the $5 million park include two lighted baseball fields, two basketball courts, picnic facilities, a playground, an Asian garden, a trailhead for Mount Rubidoux, and environmental efforts to preserve the land to its natural state.
There is an actual area, there's an area that as part of the environmental impact report that we want to preserve, and there's a couple of things that we've done as a result of the environmental impact report that will preserve some of the amenities that are native to this area. We'll have some native plantings. We'll have the alkaline meadow area that's been that'll be designated, and then one of the other things that we're looking to possibly do is incorporate some interpretive panels that provide a little bit of the history and a little bit about the area, the vegetation, the wildlife that surrounds the area. So
the park is designed as a combination of passive and recreation activities. Many of the neighbors, the immediately adjacent neighbors, were looking forward to a park that had some passive activities such as walking, large green spaces for flying kites, playing frisbee. And they were also looking at places where programmed sports could occur. It was really very fitting to include an Asian garden. In fact, we're standing just about where that Asian garden will be constructed. It's a very simple design. It's going to be defined by short walls and plantings, and in the middle of the garden area, there's some sculptural rocks that will be constructed.
Working with the neighborhood to design the park they want has resulted in this being truly a neighborhood park, as opposed to something that a consultant or the parks department itself decided would be good for the neighborhood. So this is what the neighbors want.
Although known as Tekesquite for more than 100 years, the question of whether the name will be attached to the finished project was still unknown during the ceremony.
I think there's considerable support from the naming this park after Officer Bonamini. Somebody was trying to make a judgment about how we should name parks, and I think we name parks for different reasons at different times, and so I look forward to the process, and it'll happen before this park is opened. So it may be Tekesquite or it may be Bonamini.
Whatever the name of the park, this long dormant land near Mount Rubidoux will be a lasting tribute to the city and residents working together to create a lasting recreational parkland for everyone. And as this project begins, another long-term project is ending, the Magnolia Grade Separation. Let's go to Bridget for the final update on this vital transportation issue.
The Magnolia Grade Separation is finally done. More than a year ago, Riverside decided that the time had come to fix the problem that had been plaguing the city's downtown traffic for decades. Trains that ensnare traffic.
We had the railroad gates down over 2 hours a day on Magnolia. It's a lot of inconvenience and delay, not only to the motorists, but also to the emergency responders.
It's very frustrating when you're sitting there and you have somewhere to be and you've thought you've allotted enough time for yourself. You know, you're stuck behind a train for 20 minutes sitting there, and there's nowhere to go. There's cars in front of you, cars behind you.
Now that we have a grade separation with cars passing underneath, it provides the ability for our residents and business owners to get to where they need to go in a faster way, more productive way, more efficient way. In Ward 3 alone, we're going to have close to $150 million of grade separation investment. And that means cars going underneath the tracks. That means residents getting home sooner, getting to where they need to go faster, and again, emergency vehicles getting to where they need to go in a hurry.
The recent Riverside Renaissance was a five-year, $1.5 billion initiative that improved infrastructure and quality of life throughout the city. The $50 million project was one of the cornerstones of the Renaissance, but it was a monumental undertaking. Engineers had to shift the alignment of Magnolia Avenue approximately 50 feet and construct a two-track railroad bridge, plus relocate water, electric lines, communications, and gas lines, and move more than 6,300 feet of sewer.
The thing that really differentiates Magnolia from the other two are the amount of acquisition we had to do in terms of land. We had several properties we had to buy, and also it's right in the heart of town. We did a lot of aesthetic treatment on it to give it some architectural detail.
Construction was very much an inconvenience, but I think that the year of plus time of inconvenience was well worth the outcome. The city was awesome in keeping the residents informed and being considerate.
Although we have had construction for 18 months now, the impacts were minimal to our the people passing through. And now that we have it open, I think we're all happy and we're looking forward to 100 years of going underneath the tracks here.
The design is beautiful. The landscaping looks like it fits right in with the area, like it's always been here. The businesses across the street are visible, more visible than they were before the separation. So I think that they'll be happy that it's completed.
Well, construction around railroad tracks is always a challenge because sometimes that does include some slow orders, meaning our trains have to slow down. But for the most part, this looked like it went without a hitch, and it looked like it had some real limited impacts on our operations. So I think all in all, it went over very well.
Grade separations are a benefit for everyone in the community. Faster response times on emergency personnel, less pollution with the cars sitting there idling, and of course the quietness of not hearing the continual train horns.
The investment that we've made in this public works project, the largest public works project in the history of the city of Riverside, $52 million investment, taxpayer investment, in making our transportation infrastructure more sound and safe is going to bode well for us for the next 100 years.
The Magnolia grade separation turned out to be the right answer at the right time for what had been a major traffic headache. And now Greg takes us to another new project, this one specifically built for our city's dog handlers.
Recently, the city dedicated a new facility that has definitely gone to the dogs, working dogs that is. Both police and fire now have a home for training its canine corps, Fire Station Number 9 on Alessandro.
Well, the primary thing is it gives us a place within the city to train, and so we're not taking units out of service by having to send them out of town. When they go out of town, they're not available for rapid response the way they are when they're training here.
I think once people consider where it's at, what it provides the community, what it provides for the police department to have the training, the less costs of the facilities as opposed to paying for the facilities we used before in the Rubidoux Glen Avon area, it's a win-win for the city, it's for the department, and certainly for our search and rescue teams with the fire department having this available, and it keeps the officers local rather than outside the city limits.
This was an overgrown field before, actually an eyesore, but our plan is to improve it even more. We're going to be putting artificial turf in here, and that will be done at no cost to the taxpayers, but we're going to be using asset forfeiture money. So essentially, money that we take away from drug dealers, we're going to invest into the training of our dogs.
It allows us and the police department to bring our specialized dogs out here for training in all aspects, whether it be from police functions to search and rescue to arson accelerant dogs.
Wait. This way. Wait. Turn. Go across. Wait. Go over. Wait. Good girl. Down. Down. Good job. That's my girl.
The canines themselves, the search and rescue dogs, they have to train quite a bit. They're constantly training at least a couple times a month. And that's part of their probably everyday duties. As you can see back there, they're having a good time playing. He's also putting them through some exercises. And you just got to stay on top of it. And that's what the canine handlers do with their dogs.
Free dog. Good girl. Good job.
Even if it's just 30 minutes a day of simple obedience for some kind of obstacle work or even retrieval work, just anything. But normally you're looking at a minimum of 10 hours every 2 weeks, recertification or 8 hours every month, and then you have to go back yearly for 24 more hours of recertification. So you're always training, training, training. So your off time is spent basically doing simple obedience and things like that, but you're always training. They mainly keep us safe. It's those situations that we don't want to get into that are dangerous, such as when suspects go under a house, or they go in the attic, or they run in the orange groves, or they go inside a building. It's very dangerous to have to go looking for them by ourselves with a flashlight, an enemy, or gun in our hands for protection. The suspect usually knows where you're at. At least with the dog, we can stay outside. You know, we're not going to go into the house. We'll tell the suspect, hey, you come out now, we're going to send the dog in to find you. If he finds you, he'll probably bite you. Most people surrender. Most suspects do not want to deal with a dog, so they usually surrender. We tried to lay it out in such a way with all the property that we had that would be useful to us. Like you see that wooden box thing over there. It's actually what we call a blind. In the field, we want our dogs over there. We want our dogs over here. So in these blinds, we put situations for them that they'll go over to and at least search. And for our dogs, you know, they want to find somebody and play what we call the tug-of-war game. You put some man in a suit, and they want to go over there and bite and play tug of war and have that kind of fun. Well, in the real world, it's actually looking to find a suspect. So when I tell my dog to go over there, and when I tell him to go to that blind, he knows there's going to be fun over there. He knows there's going to be some kind of tug of war game that he's going to get to play. And by doing that in the real world, we can change it to that bush or that tree or that shed or whatever. Go over there and search. Because to them, everything they do is for themselves. They do nothing for us. All they want to do is have fun. So when we tell them to go in there and find that suspect, well, why should I go in there? Well, and we're telling them, well, go in there and you get to have the tug-of-war game. And this is what the training field allows us to do, is that we can change it in any way that we want. And we're going to acquire more obstacles as the years and the months go on. And these obstacles will be very portable, and we'll move them around. And every time we run into the situation in the real field that kind of stumps us, well, why don't we reenact that? Let's create and reenact where the problem arose, and let's try and fix it through training.
The relationship between police and fire is great, and just another opportunity for us to work with each other.
The fire department's philosophy and training is quite a bit different than ours. There are some aspects that are the same, but for the most part, the philosophies and training are different for the fire department compared to us. You know, for our dogs, you know, we're actually on a mission to find things or people. And when we find them, there could be a use of force involved, which involves usually a bite of a suspect. With the fire department, they're not looking to bite people. They're looking to find and rescue people. Our dogs obviously don't work that way, but the philosophies eventually mesh and go in the same direction, because there's a mission to be had at the very end.
What I learned from the police dogs is do whatever the canine handler says to do. That's what I've learned.
Whether the canine works for the city police or the fire department, the facility will give the city years of training, making Station Number 9 one of the most versatile public safety units in the city, but only by virtue of dogged determination. Mary now takes a look at a new city program also concerning dogs, but this time, a way to return lost pets.
Finding lost animals has long been a problem for pet owners. Our four-legged friends tend to roam, and sometimes a collar isn't enough. Now, the city has a new program that will eliminate the guesswork when you and your pet are separated. And it's all done with the help of modern microelectronics.
The microchipping process, there's still some trepidation out there in the world that's like, oh, is this going to hurt my cat? Is this going to hurt my dog? There's been a lot of studies that indicate that these chips are safe, and they're a great way to get your pet back.
This fine little dog, 3-month-old Cocker Spaniel, has a microchip. But there's probably nobody on the planet who can tell you that it does, because it was implanted yesterday. And as we can see, the dog is none the worse for the process. Microchip is generally about the size of a grain of rice. It is implanted with a hypodermic needle and syringe, much in the same way that a regular vaccination or an injection with antibiotics would take place. It occurs in dogs and cats underneath the skin, above the shoulder. Most of the time, the animals don't even know that we've done it. As a matter of fact, we do little kitties that are about that big, 8 weeks of age, prior to adoption and going home with a new family, and most of them act like nothing ever happened to them.
Populations in animal shelters like this have skyrocketed during the past years to as much as 25,000 animals passing through annually. And as County Animal Services has found out, not all of them have identification around their necks.
It is the only reliable, permanent form of identification. We are all familiar with dog collars and a tag on it. So the microchip is permanent. It is encrypted, so it cannot be illegally tampered with and the numbers changed. But once it is picked up by an animal control jurisdiction or at a veterinary practice, simple scanning will bring up the number. Accessing the database will provide the contact information for the animal's owner, and hopefully a successful reunification will take place in short course.
But it is very, very critical that the pet owner, if they move or they change their cell phone number, it's very important that they update that cell phone number, update their address. If they actually give the dog to their brother, make sure the brother's name and cell phone number. Otherwise, you know, we're calling a number that's no longer in service, and that's never a good thing.
For the calendar year 2012, the City of Riverside is offering a waiver of their license fee if you have a newly microchipped animal. Specifically for dogs, if you have an altered dog and a microchipped dog, we will waive the $16 license fee. And it's a waiver of $10 for a senior license fee.
When our veterinary team members or our officers scan that coat of the fur and suddenly hear that beep, it's a magical sound. It is really the sound of an animal going home.
Finding your four-legged friends has never been so easy. Take advantage of this year's fee waiver and ensure their safety and your peace of mind. On behalf of Bridget Amaya and Greg Lee, thanks for joining us for this edition of Riverside Today.